This hour of the Jason Rand Show is brought to you by Farrah.com. We've got a lot of news happening all around the world and right here at home. It's time to find out what's trending.
What's trending at home?
The Seattle Times is on a mission to get faculty in Washington schools to be more racially diverse because, well, like a lot of liberals, they care more about virtue signaling how heroic they happen to be. They're here to help all people. They care about diversity, not diversity of thought or opinion or ideology. Only the kind of diversity you could see. And in this case, they're saying research shows students of color benefit academically and socially from having teachers of the same race, which, okay, I hear you, but I've got some questions about how this is all supposed to look. Because it sounds very good, and you get to pat yourself on the back for calling for more diversity, and you'll sound like a hero who really cares about communities of color, but I wonder if you actually understand the impact of what it is you're asking for, and maybe we should reconsider and push something that makes a little bit more sense for everybody. Because they show you that here in Washington State, people of color make up 11.7% of the teachers, yet when you look at public schools across the state of Washington, you have nearly 50% students of color. They don't really tell you, of course, where the teachers of color are in relationship to the students of color. They simply say students of color are quickly approaching nearly half of the state's public school population. That doesn't give me a lot of info. Is that not the case, right, in every single school district, right? Yeah, I mean, just so we're clear about something. Because I find this interesting. We have 11.7% of teachers, faculty members of color, but almost 50% students of color. Okay. There are some districts that don't reflect those numbers, yeah? That it's not equally applied all across the state, that some states have a higher number of persons of color than others. Certain counties, certain districts. And so in those schools, how many of the faculty members are faculty members of color? That would make, I suppose, an important argument here. Because if we've got a school that has 97% white kids, are you saying we shouldn't have faculty members who are persons of color, or we should? I'm a little confused. I'm not entirely sure I know what it is you're asking for. So what they want to do is just get more people of color, because in their eyes, they think they can help certain students. And so now they want to make it easier for communities of color to become teachers. Now, they imply that right now it's too hard because of institutionalized racism, which is, okay, that's kind of bogus. That's not, okay, fine. So here's my question. Here's the question I have. You're saying it's too hard because of institutionalized racism. Got him. Why is it that one of the things the state wants to do is get rid of a test that teachers have to take in order to become teachers in the first place? They say people of color fail at higher rates on this test than white people. Okay. So instead of actually coaching them up, they get rid of this so-called barrier. Does that make sense? No. I would say, why get rid of a test if the only reason you're getting rid of the test is because there are more white people passing than black, Latino, or Asians? Can you tell me why black, Latino, and Asians are not passing the test? Is it because of institutionalized racism? Is there something that I'm missing here? Now, let's say that, yes, actually, Jason, here's why. Okay. Can we not adjust the test? Why are we just getting rid of it? And by the way, I've got questions, and I know I'm not supposed to ask these questions. I'll probably get in trouble by some blogger for asking these questions, but if black students react better to black teachers and you end up hiring a black teacher for the students, what impact does that have on white, Latino, Asian students? Because it doesn't say in this article in the Seattle Times that desperately wants me to know how heroic they are for taking this position. Now, maybe it has no effect whatsoever, but if you're telling me a black student will do better with a black teacher, doesn't that also mean a Hispanic student will do better with a Hispanic teacher, or a white student would do better with a white teacher? So if you hire a black teacher, for example, to address this problem, and we're just doing it willy-nilly to raise the percentage, we're not looking specifically at individual districts that have maybe a disproportionately high number of Latinos or of whites or of black, whatever it happens to be, aren't you then hurting the Latino students and the Asian students and the white students and all the other students who are not African American. And the same thing, if you hire just a Latino teacher, are you then not hurting the black students? How about this? And go with me for a second, because this is going to be a little bit controversial. And Tom, you can tell me if it gets way too controversial here. Okay.
Oh, you passed that line a long time ago.
Did I? Well, if I pass the next line, or if I repass a line, tell me. Okay, here's a question I have. Can we focus maybe, instead of this data point, ways we can make it so that teachers, regardless of race, will be able to better inspire and engage and relate to students regardless of their race? That maybe in a perfect world, we can have a black teacher who equally inspires black students and Hispanics and Asians and white kids and all, like, oh, can we do that? And maybe the same thing. Can we get that white teacher to make sure that they are better able to relate and engage and inspire black students and Hispanic students and Asian students? Is it possible that we can say, hey, teacher who is heterosexual, we would also like you to relate and then engage and inspire the gay kids or the trans kids? Like, can we not have that? Why isn't that where we go? Or why isn't that where we aspire to be? Why do we aspire to just decide to hire people based on the color of their skin or their gender or their sexuality, just so we can say, well, they're going to then do better with the people who look and act just like them? Is that really what we want? Don't we want everyone to be treated as equally as possible? I know that we're never, ever, ever going to get to total equality. There's never going to be total equality of outcome. We're never going to be able to get that. But we can't get to equity, right? There's a difference between equality and equality of outcome. They want equality of outcome. We're never going to be there unless you cheat the system. There's always going to be someone through, for whatever reason, who won't perform the same as a counterpart who is of a different race. And sometimes that means a black student does better than a white student. A white student maybe sometimes does better than an Asian student. But we're never going to be able to get to the point where equal outcomes. But can't we work at least a little bit harder? Just a little bit harder to get it so that a white teacher is better prepared to teach a black student, and a black teacher is better prepared to teach a Hispanic student, and a Hispanic teacher is better prepared to teach an Asian student. Can we get to that point? Why don't we talk about that? Why are we not talking about that? Why is the conversation, we just need to hire more black students or black teachers? Hire black teachers and Hispanic teachers and Asian teachers. Hire anyone. I don't care. I just don't like the way that we dismiss what we should be really having a conversation about, which is treating people equally, inspiring kids equally, engaging kids equally. I don't get it.
Do you get off?
Oh, I know.
Me sick.
I know. Get in line, man. Get in line.
Unbelievable.
1-800-465-8770 if you want to join the conversation on the None Better Tax Resolution Hotline. 1-800-465-8770. We did get a text message that accuses me. You are too rational. Oh, that was a compliment, though. Thank you. I appreciate that. Let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending? Wait, what?
Okay, so John Hickenlooper, he's a pervert. The Democrats got a dude who's running for president who's a total pervert. Why did you give me that look?
You came out really strong.
Because
yeah,
he's a perv. He's a perv. Let's just be upfront about it. He was on CNN last night, and he was talking about, I suppose he was trying to relate to the audience by telling them about his relationship with his mother.
Actually, the CNN anchor brought up the story. She said, I heard you did this.
Yes. What she heard was John Hickenlooper, former governor of Colorado, took his mother to a porno movie.
She was just a strong, powerful woman who got stuff done in her own right.
Oh, and by the way, can you stop pandering with that kind of language? She was a strong, independent woman who was just say you loved your mother. I don't assume that you have a negative viewpoint of women. It's okay to just say, I don't say my father was a tough, get-it-done male. Just say your mom.
And I got home and she had this huge dinner laid out. And I said, I promised Jed that we'd go to the movie theater and see this new movie. You want to come? And it's an ex movie. I don't know. And I was sure that she wouldn't say no. I made a mistake.
Okay, I was sure she would not say no.
I think you just fumbled a little bit.
Because it also kind of seems like he lured his mother into an X-rated movie or an X movie. How old? He's not that old to talk about things. I'm going to an X movie.
And she said, I'd love to go, because she didn't want to be left alone in the house again.
It was a pretty famous movie, too.
So I took my mother to see Deep Throat.
I have questions. Number one, as an 18-year-old, which is when this happened, I find it hard to believe you don't know what an X-rated film is. Number two, when it was clear in the theater that it was, in fact, a sexually explicit film, did you leave or did you stay?
Those are both really good questions.
Did you go past the first scene just thinking, okay, maybe that was just a weird one scene, it's not going to happen again, and then it happens again, a sex scene that's very explicit, that's clearly a pornography film. At that point, do you leave? Does your mom just leave? Does she stay? Do you stay? Do you stay and she goes? Does she stay and you go?
Maybe the plot was just really good. Maybe they were drawn into it.
The plot wasn't so good. The music was outstanding, though. I thought the score was Academy Award caliber.
Yeah.
I'm not going to lie.
CNN hitting the hard-hitting topics over at
the town halls. They didn't pursue the questioning far enough. I would have. Dana Bash screwed that up. I would have leaned into that questioning. Ew, John Hickenlooper. You're gross. It's the Jason Rantz Show. You're listening to The Jason Rantz Show. We are live in the Online Trading Academy studio. Good news. A listener, Rantz, R-A-N-C-E, was involved in a minor car accident. The back of his car got hit, but he's fine and there's no damage to the vehicle. The reason I know this is because he accidentally sent us that text and not his wife. And he did just clarify, sorry, thought I clicked my wife's number. 1-800-465-8770 if you want to send me a text message. On the None Better Tax Resolution Hotline, let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending? The homelessness crisis.
It's no shock that the city of Edmonds, like most cities in Washington, or really most cities across the country, are dealing with their own version of a homelessness issue. But what was a bit shocking, I suppose, was a report in the Everett Herald suggesting the problem has actually been hidden. So a lot of people, including some folks in the council, aren't necessarily aware of all of the issues. So joining me to discuss this newly released report is Edmonds City Councilmember Dave Teitzel. Councilmember, thank you so much for coming on.
Good afternoon.
So I look at this report. It says at least 230 Edmonds residents are dealing with homelessness. And there's the possibility, of course, of more people who maybe weren't counted as part of this study. How has this problem been manifesting itself in Edmonds?
Well, in Edmonds, it's not as visible as we're seeing the homelessness problem in places like Seattle and Everett, for instance. In Edmonds, I think the word you used is hidden. I think that's a good term. We see people camping in vehicles along our streets and also in some church parking lots here in our area. We see people living in week-to-week motels along our streets here in Edmonds. A number of folks are couch surfing. Those are counted in the homelessness count, et cetera. We don't have a high number of folks that are actually living on the street. They are here, but the number is relatively small compared to the larger cities to our north and south.
Were you surprised by the results?
I was surprised the number was that high, quite frankly. I know we have had a problem. It has been growing. I think it's being exacerbated by what we're seeing with the housing prices here, both in the sale and the rental markets. The prices continue to go up, and folks on the margin are being pushed out, in some cases, into a homelessness situation.
Is there data to back that up, that specific point, this idea that, you know, you're kind of, to your point, you're on the margins right now, maybe rent is a little difficult for you to pay right now, rents go up $100, that puts you at a disadvantage, but are we to believe that the data suggests that they're not able to find housing somewhere else?
Well, I think in some cases they're being forced out of the area, and in some cases they're being forced into homelessness situations, either with friends or relatives or actually onto the street. So, yes, I have seen data both at the county level and also the Coney report, which was one that was most recently dealing with their Edmonds situation, and we saw presented to council last month, did allude to the fact that the pricing for housing is exceeding the income increases over the same period of time. And so, once again, folks on the margin are being priced out.
priced out doesn't necessarily mean the living out on the streets, I guess. So where's the disconnect of someone who says, I can't afford to live, say, in Sultan. I can afford to live in Monroe or literally any city. I can't afford to live in Edmonds. And so how do they get from that position to on the street rather than to just another neighborhood that they can't afford?
Well, in some cases, folks don't have the means, actually, to go someplace else. I mean, if they get priced out and you need to find another place to rent, for example, many landlords require first month and last month rent plus a damage deposit. If you don't have the financial resources to do that, plus to pay to move, which may involve renting a van or a trailer or something like that, you have very limited options.
Why is that? Why don't they have? What do you think is the root cause of why they don't have that kind of funding?
Well, I think the problem is basically just, folks that don't have, high-paying jobs, may be living on the margin, may be, operating as a barista, for example, or maybe a janitor or a healthcare worker or something like that, where there just isn't the level of resources other folks might have that would allow them to move to another place. So,
but is it an access to education problem?
I think education is a part of it. And, in fact, we do see right here in Edmonds, our Evans Community College, there are homeless students there. And the college has just addressed that by establishing some small structures for the homeless students to live in so they can continue to go to college there. If those sorts of services weren't available to the students, I suspect they'd eventually drop out and continue to struggle. So I really commend our college for taking that action.
Just joining me, we're talking with Edmonds City Council member Dave Teitzel after this report came out of so-called hidden homelessness, homelessness that's not easily apparent just by driving through neighborhoods in Edmonds. 230 people is a relatively low number in the grand scheme of things, but for a city the size of Edmonds, it seems to be growing. These are the numbers that we actually know about. Part of the problem, it seems, that I'm getting from this Everett Herald piece that brought my attention to the story is that City of Edmonds doesn't directly fund any human services, that there is, whether it's a reliance by design or just based on the circumstance, a reliance on charity work or religious institutions to do some of this work. Why doesn't the city fund?
Well, it's not entirely accurate. We do, in fact, co-fund a social worker with the city of Linwood. We pay 30% of that social worker's salary. And the social worker does, in fact, deal directly with folks who are living on the street here locally or living in marginalized situations, for example, week-to-week motels. And so we are making investments to that level. Is it enough? Probably not. And quite frankly, Edmonds just has not been stricken with the level of homelessness that we would see in our larger neighboring cities. So the demand for that kind of investment just, quite frankly, hasn't been there. But it is there now, and it's growing, and we are now in the process now of determining how best to address it. I should mention also, you mentioned the faith community as playing a part here, and they do play a role and a significant role. Yeah. So we are working on ways to partner with the faith community appropriately to determine how we can leverage our focus and our investments with theirs to bring the proper synergy to bear.
When you're looking at ways to approach this problem, do you think it's right to compare someone who's couch surfing or living in almost a roommate situation at that point with someone who's living out of their car? Because wouldn't you suggest at the end of the day that your way to approach those problems is probably going to look a little bit different?
I think that's exactly right, and you hit the nail on the head. If you're in a homeless situation, whether there actually is at least a temporary roof over your head or not, every individual is unique. They've got unique circumstances. It could be a health issue that they're dealing with. It could be a lack of a job or a recent loss of a job. It could be a mental health issue. It could be a drug addiction issue. There are a variety of situations that come to bear on this. So I think it's incumbent upon us to work hand in glove with partners such as the faith community, such as the county, such as the Verdant Health Commission and others to figure out how we can have an array of services we can provide that do fit those unique situations.
Are you seeing anything that's happening around the state or Snohomish County that might be replicable, because the one thing I think of is what's going on in the city of Arlington, the city of really just Snohomish County. Muckleteo Marysville is doing this. So whole idea of looking at it a little bit more holistically with police, social workers, and attacking it at that avenue, in that avenue.
Well, you're exactly right. And one thing the Kone study that was recently released told us is we need to do a much better job of collaboration with the police, with social service agencies, with the faith community, municipalities, our neighboring cities. We need to work hand in glove to address this, because when you think about it, homelessness is not limited to Edmonds. If you're homeless, you're not homeless in Edmonds. You're just homeless. And quite often we see the homeless will, if they're in a car, for example, be living along the street here in our city, and then next week they might be in Mount Lake Terrace. Week after, they might be in Linwood. So we need to be partnering with our sister cities as well as the agencies to effectively address this problem.
Well, there you go. For a little bit more information on this, of course, check out the Everett Herald, which is where we first saw this story. I've been talking with council member Dave Teitzel of Edmonds. Dave, thank you so much for stopping by. I really do appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for your time.
Absolutely. You're listening to The Jason Rancher, 1-800-465-8770, if you want to send me a text on the None Better Tax Resolution Hotline.
Snoqualmie, Mercer Island, Des Moines.
This is The Big Local on The Jason Ranch Show.
Shoreline, Woodinville, Burien.
Stories about you, not about Seattle.
It is 4:30 on a weekday afternoon. That means we get to do The Big Local, brought to you by Sean Keller Smiles by Design. The concept for The Big Local, really simple. The media is already hyper-focused on Seattle, so for this segment, we talk about the communities you live in, the communities you care about, and we completely ignore the city of Seattle. And we start with the big story of the state. The big story of the day. The big breaking news that the deputy from the Kittitas County Sheriff's Office, Ryan Thompson, he was killed in the line of duty on Tuesday night around 7:45 p.m., and he was killed by an illegal immigrant. He was killed by someone who was here illegally, who overstayed their visa by about 5 years, that according to ICE. It is a shooting, a death, that has completely shocked Ellensburg and the Kittitas County region. Everyone there right now is in shock, because this just doesn't happen in that area.
This is the smallest town I've ever lived in, and it feels very different. It feels very personal.
And so now a makeshift memorial is growing outside of the Kittitas County Sheriff's Office in Ellensburg. People are stopping by from all over the region to pay their respect.
There's so much love in this community for you, and there always will be.
These are folks talking with Cairo 7 TV. He was responding on Tuesday night to a road rage incident, and there was a brief chase. The suspect stopped. He got out of his car. He decided to pull a gun, and he decided to start shooting. He shot and killed Deputy Thompson. He shot and injured Kittitas Police Officer Benito Chavez. He was shot in the leg. He is recovering now in Harborview. He's going to be okay. He's 22 years old. He just got out of training, basic training. Pastor Frank Johnson says this death is leaving an empty space for a lot of individuals.
There's an empty place there in our hearts and in our community that's hard to describe. These are people whose names we know and whose children have interconnected with ours.
There's a fundraiser going on right now. It's on GoFundMe. And just in the last 90 minutes since we started, we've been pushing this hard. We've helped raise an additional $4,000 almost. The money would go directly to the family fund to help them deal with this death, to help them fund their children's education, to help them handle the funeral call, everything associated with this, even though the police community is going to help significantly, they're left without a father. These kids are left without a father. This wife is left without a husband. This community is left without a deputy who really cared about his community. If you want to help, if you want to donate some money, whatever you can donate, you don't have much, that's okay. You have a lot, that's awesome too. Text the keyword donate to the number 1-800-465-8770. Because I recognize a lot of these names on the list of people who donated. I know them as listeners. Stephanie donated $100. Greg, $100. Patricia, $100. Paul and Peggy, $50. Casey, $20. Impact Electrical Services donated $25. Whatever you have. John gave $100. Daryl gave $50. Tyler, $20. Arthur, $50. Whatever you have, please consider a donation to show them that we back the blue here. Brooke just donated $25. Text the keyword donate to 1-800-465-8770. Let's go to Tacoma. The Tacoma News Tribune is taking notice of a move that Kroger is taking. Kroger is the parent company of QFC. They're ditching plastic bags at checkout starting on April 1st. In the grocery stores in Pierce County. I'm assuming it's going to go all across the state. QFC President Susie Monfort said in a news release, "We listen closely to our customers and our communities, and we agree with their growing concerns about continuing to rely on use-once, throw-it-away plastic bags." Just real quickly, I'm in the city that we don't talk about here, so I'm going to ignore myself for a moment. Producer Tom from Auburn, are you one of the customers and members of the community complaining about, do you have growing concerns about continuing to rely on use-once, throw-it-away plastic bags?
Don't even get me started on use-once plastic bags.
Oh, God, you talk to him once and he just goes off and talks about how evil they are, except now
like
you don't.
I also like to talk to you about my keto diet and how I'm gluten-free.
Okay. She continues, "More and more customers are telling us that that using a bag once and throwing it away just doesn't make sense." I agree. I don't know how many people actually use a bag once and then throw it away. Every single person I've known who's ever used a bag, I learned this from my parents, who learned them from their parents. You use it and then you reuse it. You put it as a liner in a trash bin. You use it to pick up after your dog or your cat or whatever. You use it to throw, you know, to put away the hamster that just died.
I use mine. I put my gym shoes in the bag, in the plastic bag, and then I put it in my gym bag. I work out.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Yeah, I couldn't tell from all the protein powder that's always surrounding your stupid desk.
But that's how I reuse plastic bags, and I think a lot of people do it like that.
This is a virtue signal that means absolutely nothing. They are making a political play, and they get to make a political play here. I don't get mad that they're making a political play, especially if they think it's going to help their business, and maybe it will. Maybe it won't, but let's be just clear about something. Plastic bags aren't the problem. And since they care so much about the environment, can we just take, by the way, kudos to Robert who just donated $1,000. $1,000 he just donated. Text donate to 1-800-465-8770. Robert, if you're a listener, send me a text, 1-800-465-8770. Plastic bags are not the problem. So let's talk about what is the problem, QFC. How much waste do you think they're responsible for as a grocery store? Most grocery stores, and I don't know this about QFC, I generally don't go to a QFC, but how many QFCs are there that reject ugly vegetables and fruit? There's services right now that create, like, they ship boxes of fruit to you or vegetables that are deemed ugly because they're misshapen, they've got weird formations, they're healthy, you can still eat them, they're fresh, but they just don't look right. Lots of grocery stores reject those because they don't think customers are going to buy them. That creates a lot of waste. How much waste is being used by all of the bags and boxes to store all the products that are on the shelves at QFC? Like a huge bag of chips that only have like half the bag filled and all the rest is just empty space. Like how much of that is actually causing some of the problem? It's not the plastic bags. Now they say that their customers have indicated they don't want this. Not all of their customers, and I think that they would acknowledge that. Can I make a suggestion that maybe you provide plastic bags for the people that want plastic bags and intend to reuse them and, yes, recycle them? And then for everybody else who doesn't want it, they can bring their own bag or they can bring paper. If that's how it is and the customers really don't really want the plastic bags, then at some point you're not going to have to just voluntarily give up them just to make a political statement. They will just wind their use down and you won't be ordering as much. I don't understand why we can't do it that way.
Yeah, just
Because you can't. No, it's because you can't make a political point.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you just got to get the people to sign in blood that they'll reuse the plastic bags and you'll
what
be all
right. What is it with you and signing in blood? You've tried to sign a contract in the studio for your last pay raise in blood, and because you wanted, I said you can't get the raise then, and then you got all mad.
Well, I mean,
it's just weird, man. It's not, first of all, it's not safe or healthy for
makes
anybody.
It means something, though. It's symbolic more than anything. Like, I'm in it for the long haul.
Yeah, but we're not.
Well, it's in blood, so you have to be.
That's so gross. Do you know how many times I've had to have conversations in our HR manager's office about how inappropriate you're at your desk? Blood everywhere. Blood and protein powder. And bags filled with smelly shoes. That's literally what people know about you. They know nothing. They don't even know your name. They just know you're the bleeder.
I live a healthy lifestyle.
Except for the times when you're bleeding out.
A little blood's good for you.
Oh, my God. It's the Jason Rance Show. Welcome back to the Jason Rance Show. We are live at the Online Trading Academy studio. Thank you so much for tuning in. Thank you so much for telling all your friends about the show. We're growing. The station is growing. The show is growing. Saul Spady's show is growing. We're growing, I think, because we're talking to the people who are sick and tired of taking everything that Seattle and Olympia throws at us. Because let's be honest for a bit. There was a time when we would complain. We would just jump on Twitter, send out a snarky tweet or a Facebook message or something and complain about things that are passing. But then just something switched on. In all of us, we realize that we have a lot more power than we realize, than we previously realized. That all of a sudden, you know what? I'm not okay with showing up to a Seattle City Council member's dais and standing up in front of the public comment section and having you guys all stare at your phones and condescend me. That happened on March 11th. We played for you the audio yesterday. The video is up at ktth.com. That story is still number one. That story has spread like a virus because that's what progressive politicians are acting like themselves. Viruses that infect communities with bad policy and an inability to actually listen to feedback from the people. Now, I've told you one thing I need you to do, regardless of whether or not you live in Seattle, because I understand I'm not talking to a lot of people who live in Seattle. And I don't want this to become a show about Seattle, but I do want to acknowledge that bad policies of Seattle spread. And so for those of you who don't like bad policies of Seattle spreading to your neighborhood, let's say you live in Olympia or University Place or Linwood or Shoreline or Sammamish, you know that bad policies can come to your neighborhoods that you want to push back against. And so what I need you to do, and I asked you yesterday and the day before, is to do some research on some people who are running for council against the people who currently have power and are ruining the city of Seattle and the state with it. Now, the person who was handling the meeting in which the council members decided to ignore the individual in front of her, in front of them, was Deborah Juarez. Ann Davidson Settler is running against her. She's running against her. She's one of those candidates that I implore you to look into and consider supporting. She was on the Saul Spady show this morning and said that video that since has gone viral, that's an accurate depiction of Councilmember Juarez.
The video does, quote unquote, speak for itself, even though she's not responsive to what the gentleman's even saying. It's the story that I hear from every small business owner and resident in District 5 that I've come across, whether it's by email or by phone. Any attempt to reach out to her is met with silence or not really a responsive answer to their concern.
The problem with this council, and I said this yesterday, they don't care what you have to say. They don't care what you think. They don't care what you feel. They don't want to hear from you unless, of course, unless you agree with their positions already. And as a result, they disrespect you.
It's kind of a novel idea. Where you kind of do what you say you're going to do, right? And you treat people the way you would like to be treated, and you expect people to treat each other in just a civilized society. We have to get back to the basics of running our city, listening to our constituents, and working together. And that means listening to people about their concerns.
So just coming out and saying you will respect the voters, that's not enough for me. It's not enough for me to decide who I'm going to support. But in Davidson Settler, you've got someone who is going to be pro-cop on a council that loathes police officers.
Shaming someone for being concerned about repeat offenders coming out is not an answer. It's certainly not a solution. It's a valid concern. It needs to be listened to and addressed. We don't have enough police officers. The presence of police officers is important because it helps create a sense of order. And that is what makes people obey the law and follow the rules of how we get along together.
So if you want to learn more about Ann Davidson Settler, do yourself a favor and just go to neighborsforann.com. Ann is spelled A-N-N. Ann Davidson Settler. She is running. She's a local activist. She's a mother. She's someone who cares about her community in a city that finally the people who truly care about their communities are starting to stand up and saying they're running. If you're looking to help, if you're looking to stop bad policies of Seattle from going into your neighborhoods, you too have to raise money, spend time and energy promoting candidates, even if they're in Seattle and not in your neck of the woods. And the people who live in Seattle, not only do you need to push back against the Seattle City Council, you have to help to make sure that the Bellevue City Council stays as pro-business as they currently are. You have to make sure that in Puyallup and Renton, in Sammamish, in Bellingham, the right people get put in positions of power. So do yourself a favor, do some research on what's happening in Seattle to stem the tide of badness from flooding your neighborhood. Ann Davidson Settler is running for Seattle City Council, District 5. Her website is neighborsforann.com. There are lots of people who are running who deserve your attention. Sergio Garcia, Brendan Colding, two cops. They're running for council. Naveed Jamali, Logan Bowers. I don't even like a lot of Logan's positions, but I think he's a better reflection of the district than Shama Sawant. Ari Hoffman, Pat Murakami, lots of people are running. They deserve your attention. Please do some research. You're listening to the Jason Rand Show. Thank you so much for sending in all your text messages trying to donate to the family for Ryan Thompson, the family fund, the deputy who was shot and killed by a illegal immigrant in Kittitas County. Text the keyword donate to 1-800-465-877 if you want to get more involved. It's the Jason Rand Show.